The Country Hour with Sally Dacus.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the show. Thank you very much to Stan Murrowood. We'll have news for you again at 12:30. Well, harvesting today of underwater forests. Today is the official launch of Hydrowood, the harvesting of trees drowned when hydro lakes were created. Market research suggests there's demand around the world for this timber that has a unique story to tell. Also in the show today, TPI Enterprises preparing to harvest their northern Victorian poppy crops. Jared Ritchie.
It's one of those things where people now are seeing how the crop grows. Neighbours are getting interested. So we expect our area to double, if not triple again in Victoria next year.
Also this weekend, citizen scientists are heading to the Tarkine in Tasmania's first bio-blitz. I hope that's intrigued you. We'll have you that story after 12:30. Time now for Rural News.
Hello, I'm Kath McAloon. A foreign investment expert believes it's unlikely that China will retaliate over the blocked sale of the S. Kidman & Co. cattle portfolio after the federal government ruled purchase by an overseas buyer would not be in the national interest. Two Chinese bids, along with a handful of others, were rumoured to be in final negotiations with the company, which owns vast properties across WA, the Northern Territory, Queensland and South Australia. Doug Ferguson, head of Asia Business with KPMG, predicts a partnership between Australian and international investors could win government approval and secure the deal.
I think everyone walked into this deal with their eyes open. It's 1.3% of Australia's land, and it was always going to be a major test. I think it's just now a matter of going back to the table and looking at who your partners are, what is the ideal structure and mix to take this massive opportunity forward.
Meanwhile, the boss of Australia's largest horticultural company says the federal government must stop its knee-jerk reactions to foreign investment. Costa Group CEO Harry Debney said Australian agriculture was underinvested and industry was seeking a more consistent approach to regulation of foreign deals. He believes Australians can be too sentimental about foreign investment, especially in high-profile agricultural assets.
Never forget, you can't take the land, you can't take the trees, you can't take them to another country. And there are Australian workers that are working on those farms. So, look, we are now an Australian public company, but I would have no hesitation having an overseas shareholder. We have many overseas shareholders. And quite frankly, if they back our company, I think it's fair enough. Where they come from should be largely irrelevant.
Thousands of sheep are believed to have perished in the Esperance bushfire emergency in Western Australia. The state's Department of Agriculture has confirmed 1,800 sheep were destroyed in the fires, but that number is expected to be revised upward. Farm lobby group WA Farmers said it could be as high as 15,000 dead animals. Vet Enik Bergman has been helping farmers treat fire-affected animals and says their condition is distressing.
Almost what you call a scarecrow. They can't see and they can't go anywhere. And they're remarkable animals, but they're not going to make it through it. So, of course, we're humanely dispatching those animals. And then we're looking at the second-tier animals, those that we think there might be a chance to save.
The federal government has offered a $10 million sweetener to the region that successfully nominates to house a nuclear waste dump. Hawker, in South Australia's north, is one of eight potential sites listed to store nuclear waste, and locals are mixed on whether it would be a good thing for the region. Mayor of the Flinders Ranges Council, Peter Slattery, says the extra money as well as potential investment from construction of the site could be a real boost.
The minister announced that there will be a minimum of $10 million in that community development fund. There would be a regional committee established to help oversight where those funds went, and it's primarily aimed at economic and community infrastructure within the region.
Australian wool growers have voted to maintain a 2% levy on wool sales to fund research, development and marketing. Half of eligible wool growers voted in Australian Wool Innovations wool poll, with 67% of those in favour of keeping their levy contribution at 2% of their annual wool checks. An investigation by the Victorian Water Minister to reverse the direction of water flow in the state's controversial North-South pipeline has been labelled cruel by the opposition. The North-South pipeline was built in 2009 to pump water from Lake Eildon in the Murray-Darling Basin to Melbourne to secure city water supplies. Minister Lisa Neville says she's investigating whether water could be pumped north instead of south to relieve pressure on irrigators in the basin. But National Party leader Peter Walsh says it's obvious that plan isn't feasible.
I think it's just a cruel hoax on Northern Victoria. There is a lot of people that are very stressed at the moment about the price of temporary water for irrigation and the seasonal conditions. If desal water or the substitution for desal water is going to go to the north, it is very, very expensive water. And I think the minister's just really teasing people, and I think it's really, really not the right thing to do.
Small-scale egg producers in South Australia say they're being ignored and are rallying together to challenge industry standards. The group called Freeposa 1500 is campaigning for laws to require free range to mean 1,500 hens per hectare or less. The group's Kathy Barrett, who runs a biodynamic farm on Kangaroo Island, says industry voting systems make it almost impossible to challenge large-scale producers.
I would like the ministers and anybody that are making these decisions to actually come and have a look and do comparisons between farms that are stocking the hens at 1,500 hens a hectare or less and the bigger farms, and just make an informed decision, not be totally blindsided by the bigger end of town that are just feeding them information.
For today, that's Rural News.
Thank you to Kath McAloon. 11 minutes past 12, Sally Dacus with a somewhat deeper voice, thanks to a cold, on the Tasmanian Country Hour today. Tony Briscoe back in the seat on Monday. Well, coming up in just a moment, we'll have details of the $5 million Hydrowood project. And after the 12:30 news this weekend, citizen scientists are heading to the Tarkine. They want to come up with a list of species in the virtually unknown region. Rosemary Grant headed out, and she'll have a preview of Tasmania's first bio-blitz.
We have 19 survey leaders who will be taking more than 70 participants out into the Tarkine, and there will be everything from water bugs to birds to algae to the invertebrates, and people are very passionate about all those different things. It's Tasmania's first bio-blitz.
The project salvaging millions of dollars worth of submerged specialty timbers is being officially launched today. Standing timbers such as celery top pine, sassafras, myrtle, eucalyptus and blackwood that were drowned when hydro lakes were created are now being salvaged with special underwater harvesting techniques. The first timber is being sourced from Lake Pyman on Tasmania's west coast near Rosebery. The general manager of Hydro Wood, Darren Crook: Tasmania now clearly does a lot of clever and unique things. This must be one of them.
Yeah, no, this is right out there, but it's a good project that shows that Tasmanians have the technology within the state to actually think of unique projects and then build. The majority of the machinery was built in Tasmania, so we actually have the skills and workforce here in Tasmania that can build these specialised pieces of equipment.
Speaking of the equipment, let's go there straight away. Clearly you're salvaging timber that is still, in many cases, standing and in water that's up to 28 metres deep. How do you harvest timber in water and that depth?
Yeah, it's quite a complex mix of machinery and technology. So we have essentially it's a harvest barge that is transportable. It's a 16 metre by 12 metre barge, and we sit on top of that a 52-ton excavator. And the best way I can describe it is it's got a telescopic arm, which is like a crane, except it goes down instead of up. And, so that can reach down to 26 metres. And then on the end of that is a Satco felling head, which is similar to a Satco head that you would find in normal logging operations in plantations. And the Satco felling head operates in water. It's been modified to allow it to operate in water. And it doesn't need any oil to lubricate the bar because the water does that for us.
Mm. And obviously it cools it at the same time.
And cools it at the same time, yes. The strange thing is that we can't actually use it above the ground. So everything we do, we have to cut off underwater.
You want to make sure that the centre of gravity for that excavator arm is pretty well centred, wouldn't you?
Yes, that's right. No, we work very closely with Taylor Brothers Engineering, Slipway Engineering, down here in Hobart. They designed the barge from scratch to take the excavator. And one of the key requirements was that the excavator stays above the water.
Yeah, for sure. Clearly you've had to invent some new technology. What about the technology of using the timber once it's taken out of the water? Because like boats that come out of water, you've got to be careful with the timber and the rate at which it dries. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so we worked with the University of Tasmania, Centre for Sustainable Architecture and Wood. That's Professor Greg Nolan. When we did the feasibility study, they took that timber and cut it and did a whole lot of work in drying it and testing it. And it dries out really well. So if you do leave it out in the sun it dries really quickly and cracks. But if you dry it out in a controlled environment, it actually behaves really, really well.
But does it behave the same because you've got celery top, sassafras, eucalyptus, blackwood, myrtle? They're all, some are finer than others.
Yeah, that's right. So they all behave differently as timbers, but it's strange. They don't behave like terrestrial wood, if you want to put it that way, because the water has affected the timber in that it's essentially washed the sap out. And so it's all free water. The tree's dead and in the water, and the water's replaced the sap. And so to dry it and cut it when it's wet is quite unique. And when it's drying out, it's really just losing free water because it's already done all its...
Oh, so you cut it when it's wet?
Yeah, so when it comes out of the lake, very saturated, like upwards of 80% water content in the log, and it goes through the mill pretty much wet, and then it dries out very quickly after that. But it loses its water really, really quickly. And we're finding that, after 4 or 5 weeks after cutting, it's the timber's almost at a level where you could put it on the market as a dried product.
Which is probably faster than... Is it faster than the timber that you cut out of a living forest?
Yeah, a lot faster. Yeah, so normally you're looking at 6 months as a minimum term to get timbered to a dry status, and our timber's drying out a lot faster, and that's because the water just flows out quite freely because the tree is essentially dead and doesn't want to hang on to it.
So the age of this submerged timber, would it be 50, 55 years old?
No, the lake was flooded in 1986, okay. 1987. And, so the lake was flooded, so it's only been under the water for 30-odd years.
And is there a rate at which it will tip over the edge, or is it going to be preserved in perpetuity?
No, it's quite unique, and it's quite unique to... it's not unique to Tasmania, but the lake has a lot of tannins in it, and so there's not a lot of sunlight goes down, and because the lake is so cold, it sort of preserves the timber. There is a theory that the timber is slowly degrading, but it looks like, from what we've pulled up, it looks like it'd take hundreds of years before that actually happens.
You've got a bit of time then.
Yeah.
You're tuned to the Tasmanian Country Hour. We're having a conversation with the General Manager of Hydrowood, Darren Crook, the salvaging of millions of dollars of timber submerged in Tasmanian dams. So clearly Lake Pyman and beyond that?
Yeah, Lake Pyman is our first dam, and that'll keep us busy for at least 4 years. And beyond that, we're working with Hydro Tasmania to secure the remaining dams that we've identified and been undertaking surveys on to recover wood from those areas.
And a ballpark figure of how much volume of wood might be there?
Between all the lakes that we've identified, there's around 300,000 cubic metres.
Is that a lot?
Yeah, that's if you look at saw log cut, so at the moment Forestry Tasmania has an obligation to supply 137,000 cubic metres a year from all their forest. So 300,000 is quite a large amount. And for specialty species timber, which the majority of our timber is, that's an incredible amount of specialty species timber.
Tasmania clearly isn't the only state that has timber submerged in dams. Given the investment that you've made in the technology, can you sell that intellectual property?
We're not looking to sell the intellectual property. Although that is a possibility, but we'd much rather work with other state organisations, and we've identified dams in New South Wales and Queensland.
Oh, so you could go and do it?
Yeah, so we could actually build, use it as a unique Tasmanian industry, for want of a better word. There's a high possibility that we could make up another operation down here in Tasmania and then move it over to the mainland to work on the lakes over on the mainland.
What about other lakes around the world?
Yeah, there's quite a lot of large lakes around the world, but the way we're looking at it at the moment is that, between Tasmania and Australia, even with two operations going, there's most probably 15 to 20 years' work, and that's enough to focus on at the moment.
Fair enough, given that it is the official launch today. And just finally, you're talking about connecting the story with the product.
Yep.
How do you do that?
It's really interesting. So it's unique. It's got a unique story to tell, the timber. So this is timber that's been flooded in the past, and we're now recovering it and we're selling it. So it's actually AFS certified. So it's certified under the Australian Forestry Standard, and we have chain of custody requirements through. So we tag each log, and each log will go through the sawmill process, and you can follow it through. So when you buy a piece of hydro wood, it's been tracked the whole way through the process. And we have the log tags, and if you actually scan the scan the log tag with your phone. It's got a little QR code. So if you buy a log from us, and there is the opportunity for that, we'll auction logs to anyone who wants to buy them. And if they buy a log and they scan the QR code, it'll come up with it, the fact that it's a hydrowood log and the latitude and longitude of the area in Lake Pyman where it's come from.
Have you tested the market interest in hydrowood?
Yeah, so we've been working very strongly with that. And there has been a lag from the industry to pick it up because there's a potential that this may not actually get off the ground. But actually, since we've started harvesting and people have started to see some of the timber coming out, and especially the first product as it's come through the sawmill, there's a lot of interest from high-end furniture users, architects, and we've had interest from people over in the Monaco Boat Show and flooring people from Germany who want to deal with our product.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, Darren, we're talking about it on radio, but for those people that would like to see pictures, there'll be something on this story on ABC TV News at 7:30 this evening, and a special program that Fiona Breen has put together for Landline on Sunday.
Yeah, no, that's right. We've worked very closely with Fiona, and she's got some very good pictures. She spent a couple of days out on our operation, and she's got some very nice pictures.
All the best for your launch today.
Right. Thanks, Ellie.
The General Manager of Hydrowood, Darren Crook, Landline, ABC Television, this Sunday lunchtime. Well, now on the Tasmanian Country Hour, it's 21 minutes past 12, and more reaction to the news about the blocking of the Kidman sale. And investment experts at KPMG say the Kidman cattle properties could now be taken up by joint partnerships, local and foreign investors. The Federal Treasurer, Scott Morrison, yesterday stopped outright sale of a portfolio of Kidman cattle stations to foreign investors. It's been rumoured that Chinese investors have offered more than $350 million for the stations. Speaking from an Indonesia-Australia business conference in Jakarta, Head of Asia Business for KPMG, Doug Ferguson, says he expects a partnership to take up the properties.
Australian and international investors co-investing to build integrated food production companies that export profitably into Asia. So there is an opportunity now to take what was, I guess, presented as a control takeover of that project to being more an Australia-China or Australia-Japan or Australia-International joint venture or partnership that enables, you know, the land and the management of that precious land to be controlled in the hands of Australian management.
Do you think that there would be any retaliation, though, from Chinese investors who sought to have more control?
Look, there may be, but I think everyone walked into this deal with their eyes open. It's 1.3% of Australia's land, and it was always going to be a major test. So I think it's just now a matter of going back to the table and looking at who your partners are, what is the ideal structure and mix to take this massive opportunity forward.
Do you think it will have any impact on lowering property prices in Australia, particularly cattle properties?
No, I don't. The fundamentals are still very positive in terms of the demand for protein by Asian consumers. You know, there's also a shortage of very large-scale attractive investment opportunities. So I don't think it will. There are a number of other transactions in the last 12 months that have been completed by Chinese, by Indonesian companies, and they are of a lower profile, you know, smaller deal size, but they're still very significant. So, no, and while I'm here in Indonesia, there still seems to be, you know, very positive interest in investing and building these joint venture agribusiness companies.
Doug Ferguson is the head of Asia Business for KPMG. Well, foreign investment has played a huge part in Australia's largest horticultural producer, Costa Group, which of course owns significant berry farms across northern Tasmania. The company itself is a foreign investor with farms in Morocco and most recently in China. Costa's CEO, Harry Debney, told Clint Jasper the Chinese free trade deal is expected to bring a lot of upside to Costa, but there are still hurdles to jump.
With China, yes, I think the FTA is important. What is more important at the moment, though, is the non-tariff barriers, where there are exclusions. For example, you can't export blueberries into China at the moment because there aren't protocols for treatment of the product. Now, we and the Australian government are working to try to convince the Chinese authorities that we've got the right protocol. So I think that's the nuance that you've got to get. The FTA is a great umbrella, but within that, you've got to start to work on the non-tariff barriers.
One of the shareholders here today raised a question about the risk of investing in China, especially given the importance of IP to Costa. What kind of things are being done to manage that?
We're being very cautious about the IP. We're obviously working with the authorities because they themselves want to get more protection of IP as that industry or as the country matures in terms of the way its markets work. But secondly, we're using high security around all our farms, and we're progressively bringing in our most up-to-date varieties and putting very high security around those. So I think we've got it covered, but it's just another factor in going into a new jurisdiction. I don't think it's a deciding factor.
And looking at investment flowing back the other way, foreign investment was in the spotlight again today. Do you think Australia has the settings right when it comes to investing foreign capital in Australian agricultural assets?
Well, two things. Australian agriculture is underinvested, so we desperately need more capital investment. We can't afford to get enough funding within Australia. So Australia has for a long time needed and has had foreign investment. And I guess the concern is we're being a bit selective about where we attract the investment from, and I think we've got to be more consistent. So I think what industry wants is more consistency. We don't want sort of knee-jerk reactions one way or the other. So our viewpoint is we need foreign investment and we should be very reasoned about it and consistent about it.
Well, on that point, do you think Australians in general can sometimes be a bit too sentimental when it comes to these kind of business deals?
Yes. I mean, but never forget, you can't take the land, you can't take the trees, you can't take them to another country. So, and there are Australian workers that are working on those farms. So, look, we are now an Australian public company, but I would have no hesitation having an overseas shareholder. We have many overseas shareholders. And quite frankly, if they back our company, I think it's fair enough. Where they come from should be largely irrelevant.
That's the CEO of the Costa Group, Harry Debney, talking there with Clint Jasper in Adelaide. Well, a little closer to home now, and it's harvest time, and poppy processor TPI Enterprises is preparing to harvest their second commercial Victorian poppy crops. Jared Ritchie, the CEO of poppy processor TPI Enterprises, told Nikolai Bailharts, so far in Victoria, it's shaping up to be a good harvest.
We have. We've probably planted the lion's share of the cropping in Victoria. Our area is in the thousands, so we're very excited about Victorian growing.
And it is a pretty busy time of year, I gather.
It is. It's starting to wind up for us. We're getting ready to harvest crops in the north of the state. There's still a few weeks to go for the crops that we're growing in the more southern region. But we're very excited. Some of the crops do look fantastic. We're expecting some good yields.
Well, on that note, obviously we've seen that in some areas of the state, the grain season's looking pretty patchy. So does that correlate to poppies, or is it a different situation?
It's a little bit different because most of the area we have, the vast majority of it, is under irrigation. So some of those hot days or dry spells really didn't impact us to the same extent. So we're quite optimistic about the results we'll be getting this year.
And what kind of yields are you hoping for, and how would that compare to other years?
Well, this is our second commercial year in Victoria. The first one was really large-scale trialling of a commercial nature. But this, we think we'll get some great crops, you know, over 3 tonne per hectare. Anything over 1 to 1.5 tonne, the farmer's doing well and we're doing well. So we're quite optimistic.
And what's quality looking like?
Yeah, good. Good. The weed control's been very good, but of course it's agriculture and some regions do better than others depending on the individual season. We'll know the results in terms of alkaloid content about 2 weeks after we harvest for each of the crops, but so far the crop's looking very good.
Are you getting many inquiries about other farmers that are potentially interested in growing the crop? Are they starting to come out a bit more now that, like you say, there's a couple of crops have come through?
Yeah, indeed. And it's one of those things where people now are seeing how the crop grows. Neighbours are getting interested. So we expect our area to double, if not triple again, in Victoria next year.
And I gather too, you can now process the poppies here in Victoria. That didn't used to be the case?
For us, it wasn't. Our manufacturing facility was located in Tasmania, but we've relocated the facility to Victoria. and we've finished commissioning and we're now in production mode. So, yes, we'll be extracting the alkaloids out at our Victorian facility as soon as it arrives.
And so does that mean that for your Tasmanian operations they'll get sent over, or do you retain some processing down there too?
No, the Tasmanian operations now are used as straw storage, so the straw that we grow in Tasmania will be sent over to our Victorian manufacturing facility.
That's Jared Ritchie, who's the CEO of poppy processor TPI Enterprises. He was talking there with our Victorian country hour counterpart, Nikolai Bailharts. The Victorian poppy harvest not far away, at least for northern Victoria first up. Still to come, Richard Bailey, Phil Rush, and buckle up because we're going to head to the Tarkine. The Bob Brown Foundation has begun a citizen science project. Rosemary Grant is going to whet our appetite after the 12:30 news.
The Country Hour with Sally Dacus.
Yes, it is me, just disguised with a cold-inspired voice. Next 25 minutes or so, we're going to hear about a bio blitz. When I first heard about this, I thought maybe it was a new reality TV show, but it's not. It's a whole lot of citizen scientists. In fact, 100 of them, they're in the Tarkine. And their objective of their blitz is to draft up a complete list of species just for two specific locations in the Tarkine. Well, Rosemary Grant headed out. She put her gumboots on, maybe a bit of mosquito repellent, and we'll bring you that story in about 10 minutes' time. But Glenn Perrin's at the Bureau of Meteorology. Glenn, you're going to share with us a little bit of news about the rain in the rain gauges, particularly in the north of the state.
Yeah, so we've had some showers and thunderstorms about the north. The highest falls to 9 a.m. include 9 millimetres at Narra Cooper, 8 millimetres at Three Hummock Island, and 7 millimetres at Lady Barron Island, also 6 millimetres at Flinders Island. So generally in the order of 3 to 9 millimetres about the Bass Strait Islands and up to 5 millimetres about the north coast and northeast, with little if any elsewhere. Since 9 a.m. we've had some showers around Flinders Island, up around 2 millimetres, and some showers have pushed across the state from the west as well, but falls below 2 millimetres at this stage.
Nice to hear from Three Hummock Island. Who's weathering the rain out there, or is it an automatic instrument?
No, we'll have a rain. Someone reading a rain gauge out through there. So
hello to Three Hummock Island. Now, let's get on with the job. What else are we going to talk about for the synoptic? Because we're talking a westerly weather pattern, aren't we?
That's right. Look, we've got a trough that's over Tasmania at the moment. That's going to slowly weaken with a cold front to move over the southwest of the state late this evening as an associated low moves to the southeast. So showers extending statewide during this afternoon before those showers will contract to the west, south and Bass Strait Islands this evening. And there's a slight risk of some isolated thunderstorms across the state as well. On Saturday, that cold front will weaken early in the morning with another front to pass to the south during the day in a fresh westerly flow. Also see a ridge of high pressure extending to the north of the state later in the day. So some showers about the west, far south and central areas, and possibly about the remainder of the southeast and lower east through the early morning. Those showers will tend more isolated during the afternoon and generally clear late evening, and should be fine elsewhere. That fresh westerly stream will continue on Sunday, fine apart from some showers about the west and far south. Still a fresh westerly on Monday, with the cold front to clip the south of the state in the morning. So some showers about the west and far south, and just a risk of some isolated showers about the remainder of the south and also about the Furneaux Islands, once again fine elsewhere. Then on Tuesday, the flow will tend northwesterly during the day, with a more significant cold front to approach from the west during the day. So some showers about the west and far south, possibly extending to the north during the day. It should be fine elsewhere. And watch this space for Wednesday. It looks like we could have quite a cold and vigorous change to move through on Wednesday.
Mm. Are you suggesting frost?
I'm suggesting snow, but we'll see how we go.
All right. Are you on duty on Wednesday, or are you hightailing it out of there?
I'll be hiding. No, I'm not. I won't be here.
Now, I gather we had a few warnings yesterday. I presume there are a few weather warnings about for the coast.
Yeah, look, I've even managed to up it this morning. So for today, we've got a strong warning for northern and northeastern coastal waters. That's from Sandy Cape to Wineglass Bay. Also a strong warning for the south between Tasman Island and Lower Rocky Point, with a small craft wind alert for the southwest and central plateau lakes. That small craft wind alert continues for tomorrow, with the gale warning for southeastern coastal waters from Tasman Island to southeast Cape. Also a strong warning for the north, Sandy Cape to St Helens Point, for the lower east from Wineglass Bay to Tasman Island, and for the southwest from southeast Cape to Lower Rocky Point, with a further strong warning for Storm Bay. So with these westerlies, certainly a windy period coming up.
Mm. Have you done the swells?
I haven't done the swells.
Good.
For the remainder of today, we're looking at west-northwesty winds, 15 to 25 knots, reaching 30 knots in the south, but lighter in the east. The winds will increase to 20 to 30 knots about the north during the afternoon, and generally the winds will shift around west-southwesterly through the evening. For Saturday, west to southwesterly winds 15 to 25 knots, reaching 30 to 35 knots about the south and 30 knots about the lower east and north, but lighter and more variable at times in the northeast. So in terms of swells in the west and south, west to southwesterly 1 to 2 metres, that'll build to 2 to 3 metres tonight, then to around about 3 metres during Saturday. Wave rider at the moment, just over on a 1.5 metre average, 3 metre maximum with a 9 second period. Cape Breton at 9 a.m. had a southwesterly just 0.5 metre, and Matsyker Island a southwesterly at 1.5 metres. In the north, westerly swell below 1 metre, increasing to up to 1 to 1.5 metres during Saturday. And in the east, a southerly swell below 1 metre. In the north, reaching up to 1 to 1.5 metres in the south. That'll build to 1 to 2 metres during Saturday and even reach up to 2 to 3 metres offshore in the south later Saturday.
Now, you sure have done the swells. I put my momentary lapse of concentration down to my head cold.
It doesn't matter. We got there in the end.
We did. Thank you very much, Glenn. See you later.
Okay. Hooroo.
Glenn Perrin, the Bureau of Meteorology. And the time now is coming up to 19 to 1.
On Landline this Sunday, from mining to dining.
Everyone's figured it out, that the world is running out of beef.
Big miners investing in cattle in Western Australia's Pilbara.
The corporates coming into it, the big players, yeah, they can definitely see the potential out there.
That's Landline this Sunday at noon on ABC TV.
We'll have Richard Bailey along in about 10 minutes' time, and I see quite a big listing of store sheep sales coming up. We'll just see how livestock market's been performing in the last week. Well, the Tarkine area in Tasmania's northwest is loved, contested, and in many ways undiscovered. But this weekend, 100 people are heading out to remedy that and to fill in big gaps with Tasmania's first bio-blitz. The Bob Brown Foundation started the Citizen Science Project this morning, and Rose Grant asked its campaign manager, Jenny Webber, to set the scene.
Absolutely. I mean, it's about building the awareness around the place. It's about bringing people into the place, and it's about generating a conversation amongst people who are participating and a generation of people out there across the country and the globe who are going to be able to see on our live blog what's happening here at the BioBlitz. So we have 19 survey leaders who will be taking more than 70 participants out into the Tarkine, and there will be everything from water bugs to birds to algae to the invertebrates. And people are very passionate about all those different things. It's Tasmania's first BioBlitz.
Surely not.
It is. BioBlitzes are new to Australia. BioBlitzes are very much from the UK, and they've been held in South Australia and New South Wales. This is the first BioBlitz for Tasmania, and we're having it here in the Tarkine.
So what was about that selection? Because there are so many biodiverse areas.
Absolutely. There's so many biodiverse areas across Tasmania that lend themselves to BioBlitz, and I'm sure BioBlitz could happen elsewhere. What we are choosing the Tarkine for is that the Bob Brown Foundation is campaigning for the protection of the Tarkine as a national park. And so every time that we can get people into the Tarkine to experience and then go away as ambassadors for the protection of the Tarkine, then that's a good thing in our view.
But knowledge has obviously got to be an important part of that.
Absolutely. Knowledge is absolutely important. And so that's what this is about this weekend, is sharing knowledge, sharing experiences of people out here in the Tarkine. Crucial to a BioBlitz is the Register of Species with the Australian Living Atlas and developing the data. And any gaps that people have in knowledge about the Tarkine, we're looking at filling over these next couple of days to some extent.
To some extent. So what are your aims really? Is it identification of new species or just filling in the gaps on the map?
So the aim of this BioBlitz, like it is with other BioBlitzes, is to have citizens engage with experts in the field and to explore species, record species, increase the tally of species that we can recognise. And of course, if there's the ability to find new species, we will be overjoyed. BioBlitzes in the UK in city parks have found new species. So this is a remote location in Tasmania, which is wild, and one of the world's wildest places that's left. So if we can be finding something new in there, then that's something that we'd be looking forward to.
Now, when you say in there, There's a big patch that's called the Tarkine these days. So rainforest or more coastal?
We've got two locations that we're going into, so the plains and forests and over on the coast. So what we are having this weekend is showing that there's a variety of landscapes in the Tarkine, from the coast to the plains to the mountains and the remarkable rainforest that are the signature of the Tarkine.
With all of this activity, do you get a chance to get out there amongst it this weekend?
I do. I actually am looking forward to spending time out in the field with scientists over the weekend. It is about building the blocks, and that's right. The Tarkine campaign has been going for 30 years. The Bob Brown Foundation is new to the Tarkine campaign. Of course, Bob Brown's not new to the campaign about the Tarkine, but the Bob Brown Foundation is, as we're a new organisation. And this is one building block in our campaign that we're looking forward to continuing to build. We started with artists in the Tarkine at the beginning of the year, and we're ending the year with scientists. Scientists in the Tarkine.
Jenny Webber is the campaign manager with the Bob Brown Foundation. Well, one of those scientists is ornithologist Richard Donaghy, who's surveyed birds over the past 30 years everywhere from farms to rainforests. Richard's also written bird species profiles for the Bob Brown Foundation's new Tarkine Trails book that's coming out soon.
Yes, I was one of the early persons who came here and did bird surveys, early 90s.
So will you be drawing any conclusions about changes over that last 25 years?
Well, ideally, you should actually sort of have a census plot where you sort of survey the birds and monitor them every year, and that way you can detect changes. And I haven't been doing that. I started a bird camp sort of for 3 years and then started doing other things. So I guess one of the good things about this BioBlitz, we are having a couple of sites of different habitats, and these will be fed into a database, and ideally they should be monitored, again, not necessarily every year, but at least, well, every 2 or 3 years, and that way you can work out if there's any sort of trends. Even if you do presence or absence, you can tell whether a particular bird has disappeared or not. Like, Tasmania has 12 endemic species of birds, and just recently we found out one of those, it's a honey eater, a strong-billed honey eater, which forages up and down on bark. It seems to have a preference like for tall, wet forests.
So you might expect to see that here?
Well, if we go into the right habitat, yeah. I mean, we're going to be looking at sort of the coast and heath, but yeah, it's important to find out, you know, whether these birds sort of remain in these habitats, because these are dropping out, you know, like, for instance, at our place in Myala, we've had strong-billed honey eaters nest every year for the last probably 20 years, and yet this year they haven't turned up. So this could be part of a general pattern of decline.
Could be, or it just could be a seasonal difference. But
exactly, it could be. Yeah, so one of the interesting things is that with this sort of monitoring is that these sort of bioblitzes, they actually establish a baseline data of all the species of all forms of life. You know, so we're not just looking at birds, we're looking at plants and lower plants like mosses and bryophytes, as well as all the invertebrates like freshwater fish, frogs, reptiles, you know, snakes, birds, mammals. So that's really good to have all the forms of life. And the other good thing about what we're doing is that we're just sampling a couple of habitats. So there's about 6 species of birds that have a preference for wet forest, and the Tarkine is the largest intact wet forest in the northwest Tasmania.
Versus the heathland, what would you expect to see this blitz?
Yeah, button grass and sedge lands are important for quite a few birds. Along the coast, there's a honey eater called the tawny crowned honey eater, which is established down the coast, but it seems to be contracting its range in Tasmania. So certainly this whole southwest corner, including the northwest, is a special area. But another beautiful little bird too is the southern emu wren, and he's another little specialist of the sedge lands and the button grass plains. And of course another one is the ground parrot, which is found down the southwest, but it does occur in the northwest. And I'm not sure if we've picked that up yet in the Tarkine. So that would be pretty exciting if we picked that up as well.
Well, if you're a bit like me, a lot of little birds look like a lot of little other birds, but you must be pretty good at sorting out what's which.
Yeah, well, with the birds, but they have a range of calls which have different meanings. I mean, it's a language all to itself. So you might just hear a single note, and if you're really familiar with the birds, you say, oh, that's such and such, so you can add that to the list. So it's really important you know the songs as well as to be able to visually identify them.
That's ornithologist Richard Donaghy. Isn't that nice? The southern emu wren. Anyway, more about the Tarkine, and the primary purpose of this BioBlitz is to come up with a complete list of species for 2 locations in the Tarkine that are being targeted over the next 72 hours. Tasmania's Natural Values Atlas and the Atlas of Living Australia that record comprehensive information on flora and fauna will get all this BioBlitz data. And botanist Nick Fitzgerald told Rose Grant it's an exciting event to be part of.
No, I've never been on a BioBlitz.
What are your expectations?
I think we're going to generate a real buzz in this group because we've got a people with a wide range of different expertise looking at things that they're really passionate about and sharing those experiences instead of doing that sort of work in isolation. And we've got enough time to really get out there and look intently at a couple of fairly specific locations, which is a great thing about the BioBlitz model, is that you're looking closely at an area rather than trying to cover a lot of ground.
Nick, will you be looking for anything in particular yourself?
I'm not looking for anything in particular. I'm just hoping for some surprises, and I'm sure there'll be some interesting things that come up that people discover along the way.
What do you do with all this data? How are you going to manage that?
Well, yeah, the nature of this kind of event is that we will generate an awful lot of data, and our primary purpose is to come up with a big species list for the sites we look at, and that species list will then go into the Tasmanian Natural Values Atlas and the Australian Atlas of Living Australia. So it'll be online and accessible to anywhere in the world. That's the main outcome.
Who actually utilises this sort of data, though? Does it actually have a practical purpose?
Yeah, there's real value to this sort of data, and particularly if it goes somewhere like the Atlas of Living Australia, where it's highly accessible. And a lot of the value in it is that it adds to existing data and just builds up a picture of what we know about a region. And some of the uses are things you might not expect. So someone may be researching a particular type of group of worms, and they'll look for all the records around Australia and they'll find perhaps some from our survey, or people may be looking at the area we're looking at and wanting to know what sort of biodiversity is there. And this sort of data, as it builds up around the country, allows for studies done on a big scale that people can do just from sitting in front of their computer and accessing the sort of data that we've generated from our work.
Oh, so it's like taking a sort of particular point but then being able to join up the dots.
Well, something like the Atlas of Living Australia has millions and millions of records of different species, and it's growing all the time. And as it gets bigger and bigger, the value increases of that sort of data. If, for example, you want to know what the range limits of a species, if you look at the Atlas of Living Australia, you can see where all the observations of that species are made. You can then determine what sort of habitats it lives in and where it lives and where there may be outlying or unusual populations. So biological records certainly help build a case for conservation, and if we find rare or unusual species, threatened species in particular, that aren't previously known, then that certainly adds to the conservation value of a site. And not just the threatened species, but just the variety of common species. So the more data, the more valuable it becomes.
There you go, Nick Fitzgerald, who's assembling the data, and there's going to be a live blog for you that you can follow the progress of this BioBlitz online. You might have to go searching for that because I don't have an address. But anyway, thanks very much to Rosemary Grant for that package on Tasmania's first BioBlitz in the Tarkine. It's 1:08. Oh, what does that mean, Richard Bailey? Time to talk livestock. How are you going?
Good, Sally. How are you?
I'm good.
Good, good, good.
My boss called it the sultry hour because of my voice. I think I'd like to keep it. That's Phil Rush chuckling away in the background. Now, let's talk about livestock markets. Well, I mean, I'm very interested in sheep, with what's happening with sheep, but we'll always start with beef. So let's talk about the national beef market, and I see that the Eastern Young Cattle Market Indicators held its ground this week.
Yeah, no, it's sort of around that 5.90, 5.92 or 3 cents, sort of nudging up towards that 600 cents. It's been driven a lot by restockers, and I know that a lot of people, and I'm one of them, that think that store cattle shouldn't be in the Eastern States Young Cattle Indicator, but they are, and because the opposite to that is that during the week, in just about all markets over the water and in our markets here, we had more cattle, and it just meant that prices came back a little bit across the board, and in some cases, you know, up to 10 or 15 cents. But the restocker competition right throughout and the feeder competition has made sure that Eastern States Young Cattle Indicator is right up there still.
So where's the grass, Richard?
In parts of New South Wales, parts of Victoria, eastern Victoria. They've had some quite good rains through some areas up through, not central so much, but northern New South, a little bit of Queensland. A lot of these cattle will be backgrounded for a short period of time and go into feedlots. Some go straight into feedlots, but Yeah, because it's so dry everywhere, you know, you think that. We've had some people, well, numbers of store buyers down here as far north as Bathurst. North as Bathurst, buying cattle out of our store cattle markets and in the paddock. There's a lot of stock going across the strait at the moment. In fact, there's been a bit of a hiccup, but I think they just about cleared the backlog. But a lot of sheep coming in, a lot of lambs coming in, and a lot of cattle going out. So interesting times. But generally speaking, their prices were probably pretty similar to ours for trade cattle, anywhere from sort of 250 to 300 cents a kilo. I don't think we got over 300 cents in Tassie this last week. Their bullock market's a bit better. Most of their bullocks are sort of anywhere from 285 to 300 cents. And cow market over there is still just a tad better than us, but we stayed fully firm this week where they dropped. Most of our better cows here are making anywhere from 220 to 235 cents. Over there, 245 to 260 cents.
Mm. Let's take a look at lambs. And I saw you made mention of some fairly big yardings in Victoria, Ballarat, for example. But you'd expect that anyway this time of the year. But do you think they're a touch bigger?
No, I don't think. I don't think so. But my memory's not that flash. But Hamilton on Wednesday yarded 54,000. From next week onwards, they'll go into two-day lamb sales. And already they've split the mutton off muttoner on Thursday. They'll go Monday and Wednesday for lambs. The good news is for all producers here is that the market actually improved on the back of those big numbers, because there'd been big numbers at Ballarat on Tuesday. Heavy lambs particularly, $8 to $12 dearer, and trade lambs anywhere from $6 to $11 dearer, which meant that a lot of their averages are sitting, their trade lamb averages sitting around that 520 cents a kilo, and heavy lamb averages around 540 cents a kilo. It's good news, because up until now, our major heavy lamb exporter has been bringing lambs in from Victoria and New South Wales. I would imagine that now that price jump's happened, that they will probably struggle to do that economically, and so we'll end up, the money here will probably be a little bit better. We'll wait and see over the next week or so.
Mutton?
Mutton was pretty strong right across the board. A little bit sort of in and out here and there, but generally speaking, most mutton over there, 300 to 330 cents a kilo, which is meaning that the vast majority of sheep are making sort of $60 to $100 a head. Sally, just before I leave sheep, next week on Thursday, there's another Oatlands store sheep sale, sheep and lamb sale. They've already got about 11,000 advised, and about half of them are store lambs. Now, importantly, if you're going, don't turn up at 12 o'clock, which you'd normally do to an Oatlands sale. It starts at 10 o'clock. They're fitting in with with Rupert Gregg's last ram sale at York Plains, which is at 2 o'clock. So everything's moved around for Rupert. He's well known in the industry.
Oh, I might go to that.
Oh. Well, there you go.
They'll have a barbie, won't they?
Yeah. and of course, then there's another Oatlands sale just before Christmas, but they've got three sales this year instead of two, so that goes to show what the season's doing.
And do you think they'll be supported, Richard, the store sheep sales?
Yes, I think so. Certainly the lamb sale will be. And they'll be, like, in the processing mutton yards at the moment over here, we've got sort of five or six pretty serious buyers at the moment. And for a long time since I've seen that. There'll be some good news there to take away and mate. There's a big line of 1,600 wethers from one place, so it'll be interesting to see where they go. They may get their heads chopped off, but on the other hand, someone might buy them to grow another fleece.
Will you be at the barbecue, do you think, Richard?
Say that again.
Will you be at the barbecue at Rupert's? No, you don't have to tell me that.
I think I'll go to Oatlands at 10 o'clock. Whether or not I'll get to Rupert's at 2, I'm not sure.
Okay, all the best. Thank you very much, Richard.
Good on you, Sally.
Okay. Richard Bailey, our livestock market reporter. Now the time is 2 minutes to one, and the microphone is all yours now, Phil.
Yes, well, thank you. Last night I was doing a talk and a performance, poetry performance, and I came across a poem about coffee, which I thought, hello, I haven't done that on the ABC.
Coffee.
I've done one coffee one, but I got two, and I looked up the 900 plus poems I've done,
yes,
and it wasn't done. So this is one which I wrote many years ago, and it was from, I'd gone from Wilpena Pound to Broken Hill. I was on my way down to Mildura, and so I bought a coffee at Broken Hill, and this is a story. It's just called a long coffee. When you order cups of coffee, you can have them long or short, whether black or flat or latte or any other sort. Long, of course, lasts so much longer and is shorter satisfy, but short may suit you better and will cost you less to buy. But I've had a longer coffee than most other folk I know, for when I'm travelling interstate, I drink it on the go. I prepare it well beforehand, fill a thermos flask or two, and carry several travelling mugs, as one should always do. Now, in many of our modern cars, and certainly in mine, there is a place to put your cups or coffee mugs, you'll find. So as I drive along the road, I'll often have a drink of hot and steaming coffee, a smart idea, don't you think? Now, in the special coffee mugs, the coffee will stay hot, often for a half an hour, and longer like as not. And as I drink my coffee, I can travel quite a way. So my longest cup of coffee has been 67K.
Thank you so much for that,
and
Phil.
We'll talk to you next time.
Yes, we will. Phil Rush wrapping up our Country Hour program for this Friday. And on behalf of our Rural Reporter team, Rosemary Grant, Tony Briscoe and myself, Sally, I hope you've enjoyed the show. Don't forget to check out online and enjoy the weekend. It's 1 o'clock now.
This weekend, we'll catch up with some of the best Tasmanian prospects who are hoping they will be picked up and head to an AFL club to start next year.
Scott Rollinson.
Tomorrow morning from 11 on 936 ABC Hobart.